And why is motor racing important? Why? Because of the automobile, when it was invented. It was invented not to be raced, but to be transportation, but also, but then again, there's a sport that's connected to it. And to be able to be recognized at that level, even outside of the sport, and to feel that maybe you've contributed to some degree as far as creating attention to it or so forth, or maybe being part of the technology that is developed in a racing world where it's also then it's fed down, you know, into the production side. I mean, let's face it, there were many new aspects of the engine development that started in racing. And then obviously there was came down and funneled down to the production side. So there is a connection with that as well.
On this episode of the Future Car Podcast, you will hear life lessons from a Library of Congress living legend that has had a great impact on our society, our culture, and technology. Our guest was also knighted in his native Italy. GQ Magazine named him one of the 25 coolest athletes of all time. And he was in the first Pixar Cars movie, voicing himself. In addition to all that, he is considered by many to be one of the greatest race car drivers in history as the only one to have won the Daytona 500, the Indianapolis 500, and a Formula One championship. Our guest today is the racing icon, Mario Andretti, a racing legend whose impact goes beyond racing. Enjoy my conversation with Mario Andretti. Let's get started. You've been racing for 5 decades. You've had to stay on top of technology throughout all this time in order to be competitive. And when you started racing, they didn't even have radios in cars. And since that time, they've introduced computers, data acquisition, semi-automatic gearboxes, ground effects, and even got some of the highest level engineering talent off and on the track. So with the addition of all this technology over the years, do you think that driver skill is now less important than it used to be to win racing?
I really don't think so, quite honestly, because it's just a matter of how you use your tools. More tools you have, the more you're expected to do as far as overall performance. I always said, quite honestly, and I know what I'm talking about, that the champions of today would have been champions then, in the past, and vice versa. The human element is still very much alive in a sport, no matter what the technology talks, you know, what it means. I think the sport is regulated to the point that many things that could be automatic are not, are still manual, to keep the element of the team effect. So, I mean, you go back to when I started, for instance, that point, we were at the edge of technology as we knew it. But there was so much more to be learned. So it was natural for the sport to evolve and progress just like life has done in general, quite honestly. But here again, to repeat what I said, is that the human element is still very much there, very much important. It's just how you use the tools that are available today to the maximum. I think what this does, the challenge is now, since everybody seemed to know everything, it's just to have just a 0.2% advantage on somebody. There you go.
It's a sport of milliseconds. So no matter what, the skilled driver will take whatever machine they have, and they're going to get the most out of it. So you recently drove the 2013 McLaren at the U.S. Grand Prix. If you had to compare that to your Bronner Hawk from 69, which one was the most fun to drive or the hardest to drive? How would you compare those two?
I'd say the later, the better. I always look forward to technology, quite honestly. It's all a matter of taking whatever you have to the limit. I always encourage and love to take advantage of everything that's in my disposal. And I assure you that if I had to race, you know, a modern race car today, I would embrace that equally to the way I embraced the car, like I said, the Bronner Hawk at that time. For me, the challenge is always to take the equipment to the limit. The limit is higher, fine. You want more G's and whatever, but it's still the satisfaction from a driver's standpoint is just to be able to just extract every little bit that is available from that machine. And that's it. You know, I'm not one to say, oh, you know, in those days, that's the way you had to do this and that. You had a gated shift and all that. No, I mean, it's okay. Going back, I was at the forefront of the ground effect systems. I was at the forefront of a lot of things. Our cars in IndyCar with the Newman Haas team, we were the first ones to instrument our IndyCar with telemetry. We were testing at the Romeo at the Ford Proving Grounds. So I've experienced, you know, this whole movement in a very positive way. And here again, talking about the human element, from my standpoint, give me what's available tomorrow. That's what I'll be looking forward to.
You've raced in all sorts of different series, midget, sprint, dirt track, stock cars, Indy, Formula One. How did racing in these different categories make you a better driver? Like, for instance, how did driving in IndyCar help you drive in Formula One, or vice versa? How did driving in Formula One help you drive in IndyCar?
To me, it just widens your dimension. Experience is experience. And I'll give you a perfect example. Would you think that driving a dirt car would have some value about certain elements of driving a Formula One car?
Yeah, because you can really feel the drift and how it's oversteering.
Let me tell you where I'm going. In a dirt track, every lap conditions change. You're looking for grip. You're going high. You go low in the corners. You try to get the feel of the car. When are you confronted with those conditions? In the wet conditions on the racetrack. And whether it's Formula One or Indy cars or sports cars. And that's what it teaches you. That's what it taught me, to just take the most the ridiculous lines through the corner in a way, just to search for grip, going for the dirty part rather than, which is totally opposite in the dry. And that's what you do on the dirt.
Would you recommend that drivers starting out today start off in dirt racing? Would that be a big help, you think?
It would not hurt. But I mean, what I'm trying to tell you is that you always learn something from a different discipline because you're looking at a different animal. But the bottom line, what a driver always looks for is a balance, a certain feel that you're looking for in any type of car. Obviously, when you're going from single-seaters to a heavier car, like a sports car or a stock car, you seem to find a limit very quickly, and you have a tendency to overdrive, something like that. So, you know, these are the differences, you know. But again, overall, however, by moving around, I think all you're doing is just putting something in a bank as far as knowledge. That's the only way I can put it.
I guess the more different series you go in, you get better experience as how to drive it to that limit.
To be able to extract every ounce that's available in that equipment that you're in. And the more you experience other types of equipment, the better you get the feel for that sort of thing. So that's the way it worked for me anyway.
But occasionally you pass that line. I guess that's a big part of the skill, is knowing how far you can go, occasionally passing the line, but not passing it too often.
Well, did you ever hear my quote? If everything seems under control, you're just not going fast enough. It's all about maintaining that edge, right to the very edge of disaster. That's when you're going to set a record. That's when you're obviously going to extract every bit out of the car. You can't be sitting in a race car and feel comfortable. Just remember that. Remember that when you're doing that.
Do you ever apply that to life in general, that statement there? If you're not on the edge, you're not pushing hard enough?
Depends how ambitious you are. If you want to go above, let's say, the mediocre level, that's the way you have to think. If you want to do something in life that totally satisfies money, you got to push. You got to push. You can't be totally comfortable.
I want to take you back just for a second to when you were in Italy, before you came to the United States and you're at Monza. And that's when you've decided you wanted to be a race car driver. So specifically, when you were there, if you can go back to that moment, what was it that you saw or you smelled or you heard or someone you met that made you say, I'm going to be a race car driver? What actually happened?
Well, let's put it this way. Up to that point, I had been reading, I've watched news videos, you know, of cars in action in Italy. When Ferrari, Maserati were on the world stage in Formula One, and then you had the sports cars, the Mille Miglia, the famous sports car race around Italy and all that. But when I finally got to see with my twin brother Aldo, we got to see the race live, where you hear the noise, you just the smell, the you know, the fuels and all that, and the smell, the burning rubber. That's when you all of a sudden it captivates you. You know, it's then you're all there. My idol at the time, I had several idols, you know, Fangio, Moss, and of course the Italian current world champion at the time was Alberto Ascari in Ferrari. So as you can understand, you know, a lad 14 years old dreaming like you're allowed to dream when you're that young, he said, God, please, someday give me the opportunity, you know, to pursue this and become a race driver. And from there on, Ed, there was no plan B. There was no plan B on my mind.
Full throttle from there on.
Full throttle.
You said that was your dream. What do you dream about now?
Dream about doing something, accomplishing something tomorrow, having... Right now, what we have on the table is entering Formula One with, you know, Michael as a team owner and so forth. That's a huge undertaking, and it's a great challenge, but it's our rodeo. You know, it's what we live for. It's what we've been doing all our life, and it's what we enjoy. We have a lot on our plate to look forward to, absolutely. I have reason to wake up every morning.
There you go. How would you compare being a team owner, say, or running a racing team in Formula One to IndyCar? How do you think those are similar, different? What's the biggest difference, you think? Maybe that's a good question.
Well, the biggest difference, obviously, that you got more moving parts because you're your own manufacturer and all that sort of thing. So on the technical side, it's much more complicated. But the bottom line of the execution and everything, it's all about, you know, having the team function, your pit stops, your strategies. You know, no matter how sophisticated you think you are, you can make mistakes. You try to minimize mistakes. You know, we've seen when we watch a team, we're on the couch and we see something that the team manager doesn't see. Why in the world are they doing that? Why are they starting the race, you know, on mediums, or why are they starting on hard? You know,
it's easier from the couch.
Yes, but also there's so much to choose from. So basically, when you're comparing the two series, like, you know, IndyCar, it's just what you have available to work with and what the specific strategies are. It's got a lot of similarity, no question. You got to be a study of what's going on and surround yourself with the best people possible to do the specific specialized jobs. That's how it works. That's how any good business works.
So you've raced at Monaco, Daytona, Le Mans 25 times. You were in the Indy 500 29 times in the Indy 500. I grew up in Indianapolis, like I mentioned. I want to talk to you about the significance of the Indianapolis 500. What is it about that race and about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway that makes it the racing capital of the world?
Well, it's tradition right now. I mean, it's how many events today can claim to have been around over 100 years? You think about it. How many sporting events can make that claim? You can probably count them on a finger in one hand. So tradition is so rich, so solid, that from a career standpoint, it can make your career just by being there, because if you excel there, opportunities open up for you. That's what I experienced. Fairly or not, many times your career is judged on your performance at Indy, which is totally unfair, by the way. It's no harder to drive at Indy than it is in Milwaukee. In fact, sometimes Milwaukee on a mile is tougher or Phoenix. This thing that if you can conquer Indy, you can conquer the world, I wish it was true, but it's not. But it's just that the race has that appeal. Why? Because it's known around the world. I said this over and over that, back in the 69, I said, when I won, I started getting fan mail from all over the world where, everybody knows now. So that's what that does for you.
You were suddenly a great driver overnight.
Overnight, you're the greatest driver in the world.
You're enshrined in all these halls and walls and walks of fame. But when you were inducted into the Automotive Hall of Fame, I think it was in 2005, in your acceptance speech, you called it possibly your sweetest victory. And it placed you alongside not just racing giants, but auto industry giants like the founders of Chevrolet, Ferrari, Ford, Honda, Porsche, Toyota. Tell us a little bit about what it's like to be in the Automotive Hall of Fame with all these automotive giants. I mean, it's an honor. It goes beyond racing. I mean, it's truly an automotive industry honor.
Well, you just said it. You said it all. And look at where you are celebrated among the icons of our industry. And why is motor racing important? Why? Because of the automobile, when it was invented. It was invented not to be raced, but to be transportation, but then again, there's a sport that's connected to it. And to be able to be recognized at that level, even outside of the sport, and to feel that maybe you've contributed to some degree as far as creating attention to it or so forth, or maybe being part of the technology that is developed in a racing world where it's also then it's fed down, into the production side. I mean, let's face it, there were many new aspects of engine development that started in racing. And then obviously it came down and funneled down to the production side. So there is a connection with that as well. And so that's the reason why I think that, I suppose that you're considered to be part of it. And that's where my appreciation for that recognition is honest. And it's very much and huge for me.
You know, sometimes I get the question of what has racing done in terms of automotive technology? And I always mention, the rearview mirror was first used in 1911 when Ray Haroon won the first Indianapolis 500.
And that's when it started, yeah.
Yeah. What do you think have been the greatest contributions that racing has made to automotive technology, to the cars that we drive today on the street?
I think it's about determining the safety aspect of the tires, for instance. The most rigorous application of a tire, which is the tire is the most important part on any vehicle, is that there's no more rigorous proving ground than the racetrack. I've been testing Firestone tires, since started in 1964. I've been part of that, and I know that progress that we've made over the years, but that's not just performance, it's safety. Because why? Because you're constantly putting the tire under the stresses that you can only dream about on a pleasure car. So when you're driving your family somewhere, taking a long trip, you can be very much at ease that you're in good shape, you're in good hands with that side of it. I'd say probably from the standpoint of safety, I think it's probably the tire is the biggest contribution. Development on the racetrack, and that's where the knowledge is spilled down to, directed down to the production side for an everyday car.
To continue a little bit about all the honors that you've gotten, your winning car from 69 is in the Smithsonian. And a few years ago, you were inducted into the Library of Congress Living Legends. And the Living Legends honors people, not just in racing, but that have an impact on culture, science, our social heritage. And there's people like Hank Aaron, Madeleine Albright, Muhammad Ali, Walter Cronkite, Barbara Streisand. and everyone's favorite, the Big Bird from Sesame Street, right? So what does it feel like to be part of a group like this that includes Big Bird and all these other famous people?
You know, that's truly an honor. And I'll tell you why, because I represented the sport of motor racing, which has been my life. And I think I'm the first one to have been acknowledged among individuals and groups like that. So that's the pride that goes into that recognition.
Your name is mentioned. I think it's like 96 songs that are out there, from hip hop to rock and roll to country music. Do you have a favorite kind of music or something like that? That if you said, hey, I love this Mario Andretti song, do you have one?
I love the one from Amy Grant. Like to drive like Mario Andretti, you know, yeah.
Perfect. I have a friend. Her name is Maureen. Now, I grew up in Indianapolis, but then when I went to school, I came up here to Boston. And I have a friend here. Her name's Maureen. We call her Mo. And one year, I was getting ready to go to the Indianapolis 500 like I do every year. And Mo says to me, oh, you're going to that race again where they turn left. I drive to the grocery store and turn left and right. That's a lot harder to do. So my question is, what would you say to someone who thinks that racing is boring? What would you say to them to convince them of the beauty and excitement of the sport? What can I tell my friend Mo?
Well, they should take a ride in a two-seater and get an idea of what the excitement is all about. That's the whole thing. The characteristic of oval versus road courses, it's different, but there's a different technique, different satisfaction to derive from that. On a road course, obviously, you're a lot busier. There's a lot more diversity there, a lot of braking, acceleration, and turns right, left, and all that. Going uphill, downhill. On an oval, you're consistent high speed, and you got a couple of corners that you have to execute. But the G-force that obviously you experience there under strenuous circumstances, and also realizing that no mistake is a small mistake. The slightest mistake could be a disaster. All of those elements play. And if you're out there on the sidelines, oh, well, it's boring, this and that, you haven't got a clue what you're looking at or what this is all about. But try to put yourself in that seat. You know, where like in Indianapolis, you're approaching that corner 240 miles an hour and you're turning, where on a straightaway, when you're approaching that corner, it looks like a hairpin. So don't belittle any part of it. Trust me. It takes a lot of skill, a lot of preparation, and a lot of courage, you know, to do these things.
Yeah, it's like you said, you're turning left, but you're turning left on the edge. So a slightest miscalculation. And like you said, there are no small mistakes when there's a wall there and you're going hundreds of miles an hour.
Yeah, you're right.
I think the other thing, too, is you have to do it 800 times. So there's 800 turns that you have to do. I read that I believe it was the year you won in 69, I think you were going down the backstretch and you started, at some time during the race, you were smelling the barbecue of people in the track. And that's dangerous, right? As soon as you stop focusing on racing and you start thinking of barbecued ribs or something like that, that's not a good idea. And keeping that concentration is a big part of it.
Well, you got it, obviously. It's just that what I said about that is that at one point toward the very end of the race, it was I had such a lead. All I had to do was make sure that I tried to bring it home, you know. But I was not driving on the edge per se because I didn't really have to. And when you have that 0.1% relaxation in the cockpit, you have to start wondering, and all of a sudden, yeah, people are out there, you know, in their grills and waiting to have a hamburger or hot dog after the race is over, and you start smelling that, and believe it or not, it crossed my cockpit somehow. And then all of a sudden, I know in turn two, I was just not concentrating like I should have been, and I went kind of wide, and I thought, oh, but that got my attention after that. So, you know, this shows you that how quickly you can get used to that speed, how quickly you get caught out on something where the slightest lapse of concentration can be a disaster. It's just like if going down the road and you're sort of bored and you're a little bit, you're dozing off, and you go to the side, you go to on some ripples on the side, it wakes you up. You realize how awake you're going to be from there on. You know what I mean? That type of thing. So it happened to me at that level, you know, but never again.
Well, and like you said, those little ripples on the road when they wake you up is not so bad. But when you get woken up by maybe your tail of your car slipping out, approaching a wall, that's a little bit different, right?
Well, it wasn't that bad. You know, it was just a light thing.
This whole thing about how you feel and the emotions you have, we'll use the Indianapolis 500 as an example. So you're sitting there, the cars are lined up, the race hasn't started yet, and you start to roll around. How does the feeling that you have inside you when you're sitting there and waiting for things to get started change from that moment when the green flag drops down?
Well, to be honest with you, you know, with everything that goes on, all the hoopla and everything.
The pageantry.
The pageantry, that's my word. That goes on, you know, you just cannot wait. For me, the best moment was when I would just lower myself into the cockpit and get down to the job that I was there to do. To be honest with you, nothing ever felt any different. I prepare for Indy like I prepare for any other race, 100%. And if you prepare differently from Indy than any other race, you're doing it wrong everywhere else. I'll give you a for instance. Let's take football. You're in football and you're in a Super Bowl. Just because you're at the Super Bowl to try to win that, are you going to change the way you've done things? You're going to change plays? Are you going to do something totally different? Or you prepare different than you did for the season prior that got you there? No. You never win that if you do that. So it's a lot of people think that at Indy or there, and I was never more nervous at Indy than I was anywhere else. I tried to treat that, I'm telling you, the same way. I'll give you another example. You're at the hotel, and the night before the race, you know, you're coming from whatever, an event or whatever, and they see you there at 9:30. The people, Mario, the race tomorrow, it's 9:30. I said, 9:30? I said, well, I don't go to bed until about 11. Oh, my goodness. Because why? Because that's when I go to bed all the time at every other race. And that's when I go to bed and I sleep good. You see what I mean? It's just that but I don't go to bed at 5 p.m. because I have a race the next day at Indianapolis. That's what I'm trying to tell you. And if you do that, there's something wrong because you're going to toss and turn all night and you're going to be nervous. You see what I mean? You don't do things differently. You do things that you know best throughout. And that's how you're going to perform the best at Indy or any other race. They're all important.
So you get your routine. It works for you. And it doesn't matter if it's Indianapolis or Formula One or a dirt track. It's the same thing.
100%.
But as you're dropping down into the car, and now you're sitting there and waiting, you know, you're waiting for the cars to pull away and eventually get the green flag. Is there a change in what you're feeling? Like, are you feeling a little anxious or nervous maybe at first, but then it all goes away as soon as that flag drops? Or is it like, I can't wait to go right from the start?
I'll tell you what, Ed, I cannot emphasize enough. My so-called butterflies were the same size at Indy as they were everywhere else. Trust me, that's the way it was with me. If I don't know how it is with anybody else. The only difference, the result can be much different. But that takes care of itself. But before that result comes, the approach to me should be the same as anywhere. Every race that I ever entered, my objective was to win it, no matter whether it was realistic or not, as far as my chances. But my mindset was always the same. That's the way I operated.
Do you think your butterflies were the same in the 60s as they were in the 80s and the 90s toward the end of your career? Did it stay the same?
The same, and it was the same age, too. The butterflies stayed the same. As I aged, the butterflies stayed the same.
You aged, but the butterflies didn't.
You know what's interesting is that, you know, you start racing, and of course, there's a lot of things because you have different type of anxiety because there's a lot more unknown. So you do have this butterfly. If you don't know, have those butterflies. And I kept saying to myself, you know, man, I just hope that maybe as I keep racing more and more, these butterflies are going to go away. You know, that I probably I wouldn't have this type of anxiety. You know what? It didn't. And I think that's good. You know why it's good? Because it was important to me right to the very end, to my very last competitive race. It was just as important. So it was nothing, as a matter of fact, oh, yeah, I got this and this and that. And there's no such thing. There was always something new potentially to experience, no matter how long you're in the game. If you never, ever got to feel, oh, I got this 100%. No, you got it. No, you better be prepared. And so that's the beauty of it. And that's what, to me, that's what kept me motivated throughout, because it was never blasé, if you know what I mean. There's a difference. There's one thing, like if you're a parachuter, okay, the early jumps, you know, are going to be, you know, more. Then after a while, oh, it's a matter of fact. But that's different because, you know, you're not against somebody else. You know, all you do is get used to something easier. In a race car, no single day is the same as the day before. Trust me.
Well, let's talk about a little bit about racing wheel to wheel, because you've raced against Foyt and the Unsers, but they're not family. And you've also raced against your son, Michael. So my question is, when you raced against Michael and you saw, you know, you're about to make a pass or you're wheel to wheel, did you change your driving style or your level of aggressiveness because it was your boy that was next to you and not A.J. Foyt or Al Unser?
Well, a little bit, because I knew that I would have to deal with my wife. You know, so I kept that in my head, because it's funny that she always used to say, Mario, is your son, you know, every time you two are wheel to wheel, there's always have to touch, you know, you're too aggressive. I said, well, you know, we do it. If we're going to touch wheel, it's going to be somewhere like in a hairpin or something. It's not going to be at 300 miles an hour, you know. So we made sure that we took care of each other. However, neither one wanted to give an inch, you know, and that was the beauty of it. The competition was there, clear between us, as solid as you could ever be. And, you know, we can still talk about those moments. Quite honestly, Mike and I have been on the racetrack with Jeff and my nephew John also, you know. Mike and I have had moments, because we've been on podium 15 times in an IndyCar race. And we've been first and second 5 times, and on the front row 10 times. On the front row, so it's 5, 10, 15. How beautiful is that, you know, from a standpoint for where I stand as a father? You know, that's what racing gave us. And there were a couple of precarious moments in our time together. But as you're driving aggressively and so forth, you know, there's always the potential of a mistake, no question. And sometimes if you try to slice somebody and so forth, it could cost you more than the guys you're trying to do it to. So everything has to be measured. I've been guilty of some mistakes here and there, for sure. But especially when you're up against, like, your own guy, you figure, I have to take it all at the end. I mean, she'll just wring my neck, you know, if I spin him or something. As a matter of fact, I give you an example. In Poconos, forget what year it was, Michael was leading, and I was second, and I was trying to overtake him going to turn one, and I came down, and he kind of chopped me a little bit, and so I wouldn't hit him. I spun and kind of almost broke my shoulder, you know, when I hit the wall up there. So I sacrificed myself so I wouldn't spin him. Otherwise, I would spun him and maybe crashed into him or whatever. So that time I for sure sacrificed myself, because I wasn't going to face my wife.
Well, if your wife's happy with what you're doing, you'll probably do a better job on the next race. So I'm sure that was the right choice. I want to ask you some questions here about the future of racing, because a lot of things are changing in racing. The first question is, if you could implement a new rule right away, let's say for IndyCar or Formula One, any idea what that rule might be?
I have no idea right now as far as it's not as easy as that as, you know, the idea is to try to make the cars even aerodynamically in such a way that it's easier to follow and so on and so forth. Everybody's trying to do that. I mean, every series, the technical side are trying very hard, you know, to make it possible because what makes a race interesting when there's a lot of overtaking. And I think a lot of what is being done right now is really, if I would have the answer to a rule that would be the exactly what we need, I would bottle it and sell it.
There's a lot of emphasis now, for instance, Extreme E and Formula E, for racing to emphasize sustainability and diversity. How important do you think it is for racing to do that?
Well, racing is part of the technical innovation. There's room for everything. That's why you have all these categories. You have Formula E, you have Sports Prototype, you have Extreme E, and you have Rally, you have everything. But this moment, there's always a drive to try to make things more efficient, just to reduce the carbon print, you know, so to speak, and be an example. Just come up with something as efficient as possible that can be filtered down to the production side. And it's a test bed. So, I encourage all of these aspects of technology, no question. The one thing that I don't endorse is the fact that you think, oh, yeah, everything's going to go electric. I don't think that's sustainable either. There's another problem, you know, in that respect. So don't talk to me about that part.
All right. We'll let that go. Mario, listen, thank you so much here. Before I let you go, though, I want to ask you some really quick questions. So quick question, quick answer. We call it rapid fire. You're used to going fast. So rapid fire, racing fast questions. Are you ready?
Shoot and aim correctly.
All right, I'm aiming right for you here. So here's the first one. Now, when you gave your speech, when you were inducted into the Automotive Hall of Fame, you said, if pure love for the automobile is the only criteria for the award, then I deserve it. So what was the first car you fell in love with?
My 1957 Chevy. And I was a king of the block there, along with my brother Aldo. That was our first new car, you know, as a family even. And that's it, 57 Chevy.
Could you tell us your best speeding ticket story?
The one I got away with.
How many of those?
A few.
If you could have had a career in anything else besides racing, what would you have picked?
That of a fighter pilot.
That's even faster. Do you have a favorite fighter plane?
Well, the ones that I had, the most favorite, F-15, F-16, F-111. That's what I had experience in.
So you've been in one then?
Oh, I've been in more than one.
If you had a five-hour car ride, what person, living or not, would you want to spend that five-hour car ride? Anyone from the past or living today, who would you want with you for a five-hour car ride?
Enzo Ferrari.
What would you ask him?
A lot of things.
What's the fastest you've ever driven a regular car on a normal road? Not a racetrack. No? All right, we'll take that as your answer. You have to watch the video to see the answer to that one. Your greatest talent not related to racing. Greatest talent not related to racing.
To relax.
You're a good relaxer.
Be able to relax.
I guess that gets you ready for the next race then.
Yes.
If you could magically invent one thing at the snap of your fingers, what would that be?
How to walk on air.
Well, that's a good one. If you could uninvent one thing that's been invented in the history of humankind, if you could uninvent one thing, what would it be?
Well, uninvent is try to uninvent ignorance.
Very good. I think that's the best answer I ever got to that question. And here it is. This is the final question. Tell us something about yourself that would surprise your friends and family, something they don't know about you.
I think that I'm easy to satisfy.
They wouldn't agree with that, huh? That would be a surprise. Mario, grazie che sei venuto sul Future Car Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Ed.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks. All the best to you.
All the best to you, too.